about halfway between the two small communities of Newton and Wicksburg. It's a small, very modest cinder block home. Where a man and his wife and his seven children lived. As his children grew up, they had a child late in life. The seventh one was somewhat a surprise. And an older brother to that youngest boy, who was already married, gave his little brother a bicycle. He was so happy to have that bicycle. And on that day in August, this mother went to the door, called to her son who was riding his bicycle there in the front. She said, "Call your father in for lunch." His father was on the other side of the highway where they had a garden spot. And immediately, that boy jumped on his bicycle and took off across that gravel driveway right out into the highway. The woman saw the truck coming. And she screamed. Her scream alerted the father, who was on the other side of the highway in the garden, so that he stood up to see. With one on one side of the highway and one on the other, they watched the truck hit their child. The little boy lay in the hospital for 2 weeks. On September the 5th, 1959, I was born. And on September the 6th, my father's birthday, my father's youngest brother died as a result of an accident with a bicycle that my father and mother had given him. It was a tragedy that my grandmother, my papa, would never get over, really. But it wasn't the end of the story. It's not the end of the tragedy. Later in life, my grandmother developed Alzheimer's disease. Simple things at first, but as the disease progressed and as the situation became more serious, she began to have periods when she was totally disoriented. And night after night, she relived the nightmare. And in the summer of 1981, there was some road equipment coming down the right-of-way of the highway, mowing the right-of-way. My grandmother, being confused, heard the noise. She went to the door and immediately started reliving this. She started screaming for Ronnie, my uncle, who was killed when he was 12. And she went rushing out into the road. The young man was 22 years old who was driving the tractor with a bush hog behind him, and he was watching very carefully the mower. He never saw my grandmother when he hit her and threw her back into the highway. My grandmother was a Christian. My grandfather. Someone says, how do you explain that? I don't explain that. But I do want to say something to you tonight as we begin this particular discussion. If there is one area of life where all of mankind seems to come together, in an area of commonality, it is in the area of human suffering. And if there is anything in life through which Satan might test and try and prove our faith more than in any other area, in my mind, this is the area. The book of Job tells the story of a man who was living a good life, a righteous life, had everything going for him, and his life fell apart. So tonight, as we talk about the reality of suffering, the problem of suffering, and the Christian's response to all of that, his attitude toward it, I want to take some principles from the book of Job. I do not pretend that what I'm going to say to you tonight, that these things are original with me. I have been greatly assisted in my study of the book of Job from a number of different sources. G. Campbell Morgan, some years ago, wrote a little book on the answers of Jesus to Job, from which I have gained much. And reading and studying after him or in his thoughts along that line. Tim Kinzel, whom some of you know, worships with the church up in Gainesville now, a few years ago taught a class on the book of Job, the College View Church in Florence. I would tell you that it's one of the finest classes on the book of Job I've ever been in my life. And he taught me many things about the book of Job. Other preachers at whose feet I have sat, listened to them carefully, talk about this subject, have taught me many things about the book of Job. Tonight, if you will bear with me for just a few minutes, I want us to glean some principles from this book. Job chapter 1 and verse 1. The text says, There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job. That man was perfect and upright and one that feared God and turned away from evil, and there were born unto him 7 sons and 3 daughters. His substance also was 7,000 sheep and 3,000 camels and 500 yoke of oxen and 500 she-asses and a very great household, so that this man was the greatest of all the children of the East. Here's the man that was the envy of the neighborhood. If you want to point to the guy who looked like he was the king of the mountain and he had it all, this was the guy. You wanted to be envious of someone? I suppose Job was as good a target as anyone. He was a man who had been blessed by God with a family, with a good family, with a large family. He was a very successful farmer. He was a successful rancher. He was a man who enjoyed a good reputation, not only among his family, but among his peers. He had the respect of others. The text tells us, it came to pass, verse number 6, it came to pass on the day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, that Satan also came among them. And the Lord said unto Satan, whence comest thou? And Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro in the earth, and from walking up and down in it. And the Lord said unto Satan, hast thou considered my servant Job? For there is none like him in the earth, a perfect and upright man, one that fears God and turns away from evil. Then Satan answered the Lord and said, Does Job fear God for naught? Hast thou not made a hedge about him and about his house and about all that he has on every side? Thou hast blessed the work of his hands, and his substance is increased in the land. But put forth your hand now and touch all that he has, and he will renounce you to your face. So on the day when the celestial beings were in the presence of God, Satan was among them, and the Lord said, Where have you been? And he said, Going to and fro. And he said, Have you considered my servant Job? And Satan's response to the Lord was, Well, okay, but now that doesn't really count. Why not? Oh, no, Job, yes, perfect, upright, serving you faithfully, but that is no attestation to his faithfulness or to your goodness. The fact of the matter is, you built this hedge up about it. Well, just look at his life. Look at what you've given him. Look at how you've blessed him. Look at all of the wonderful things that have come to him. Nothing bad, no problems, no suffering. I mean, he's living the good life. No wonder he serves you. His challenge was this. You let me change things. Take all of those blessings away from him. You take that hedge that is round about it. You take your protection away and let me afflict him. And I'm telling you, this Job, the one that you say, have you considered Job? He will curse you to your face. Well, the Lord said unto Satan, Behold, all that he has is in your power. Only upon himself do not put forth your hand. So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord. Well, you remember the story of what happened to him. Fell on a day when his sons and daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house. There came a messenger unto Job, and he said, The oxen were plowing, and the asses were feeding beside them. The Sabians came. They took them away. They've slain the servants with the edge of the sword. I only am escaped to tell you. While he was yet speaking, there came another messenger. And he said, The fire of God has fallen from heaven and has burned up the sheep and the servants and consumed them. I'm the only one who has escaped to tell you. And while he was yet speaking, there came another and said, The Chaldeans made three bands and fell upon the camels and have taken them away. And they've slain the servants with the edge of the sword, and I only am escaped alone to tell you. And while he was yet speaking, there came another, and he said, Your sons and your daughters were eating and drinking wine in their oldest brother's house, and behold, there came a great wind from the wilderness and smote the four corners of the house, and it fell upon the young men, and they are dead, and I only am escaped alone to tell you. Here was a man who at one moment it seemed he had it all. And just that fast, he lost it all. But the text says, Then Job arose, and he rent his robe, and he shaved his head, and he fell down upon the ground and worshipped. And he said, Naked I came out of my mother's womb, and naked I shall return thither. The Lord gave, and the Lord has taken away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. And in all of this, Job sinned not, nor did he charge God foolishly. Didn't break it. The Lord was right. Satan was wrong. Well, Satan came back to the Lord and he said, Oh, well, that's still not the same. It's not the same. You know, you let me take away the other things in his life, but you've not let him hurt. I mean, afflicting his body, his physical body with pain and suffering, disease and tragedy. Let me put my hand on him. It's one thing to feel for the pain of other people, but that's not the same thing as your own physical suffering. Job 2 and verse 4, Satan said, Skin for skin. Yea, all that a man has, he will give for his life. Put forth your hand now and touch his bone and his flesh. He will renounce you to your face. The Lord said unto Satan, Behold, he is in your hand. Only spare his life, So Satan went forth from the presence of the Lord, and he smote Job with sore boils from the sole of his foot unto his crown. And he took him a potsherd to scrape himself therewith, and he sat among the ashes. From the top of his head to the bottom of his feet was covered with boils. Talk about a pitiful condition. Here's a man who was at the top of the world. He lost everything he had, and now his condition becomes even more pitiable and pitiful as we see the man covered in boils, sitting around with a broken piece of pottery, scraping the scabs off of himself, writhing in pain. And his wife is no help. She said, I cannot believe that you are still maintaining your integrity. Curse God and die. His three friends come, and they are no help. They come to offer him help, but they had nothing to offer. They go through a series of speeches throughout the book of Job. And over again, they're just saying the same thing. They're saying, come on, Job. Come on now, fess up, tell us, be honest here, put it on the table. We know that there's something amiss in your life. Job, you know, bottom line, you are suffering. All of this evil has come upon you because, bottom line, you deserve it, Job. Now tell us what you've done. You need to confess your sin and repent of it. Well, Job knew better than that. So do we, because we read what the Lord told us about Job. Job knew better than that. Job knew he was not suffering because he was a bad person, living in hypocrisy, sinning against God, living a life of rebellion to the will of God. He knew that that was not the case. But his friends were making the standard argument of the day. And it's one of the standard arguments of this day when people are suffering. It is the argument that says people suffer because they deserve it. Job's response was, look, I'm not telling you I'm sinless, but I am not the kind of sinner that you're talking about. I am not hiding some heinous moral crime in my life of which I'm unwilling to repent, which I have not confessed. That is not the case. I am not the person that you say I am. I am not the sinner that you are implying. I do not understand why I am suffering this way. I do not understand why God has allowed this to happen to me. I wish, he said, I wish God would just come here and talk to me. I wish I had a chance to argue my case with him. If I could just sit down at a table and talk this out with God. If there were just an umpire between us, an arbiter, if I had someone to represent me before God, I'm telling you, I would be justified and I would be acquitted. I wish God would explain this. But you know what? From the first chapter to the last chapter, God never did give Job an explanation. All the blessings were returned and then some. But he never explained it to him. Even when Job is vindicated at the end of the book, still doesn't explain why. Not one word does he offer. Isn't that the way it is in life sometimes? Somebody's little boy dies. Somebody's grandmother dies. Somebody's heart is broken. Some wife and mother is abandoned by a man who just wants to go somewhere else. How could it happen? Oh, we know how it can happen in the world. And we don't struggle quite so much with people whose lives are being lived in such a way that it seems obvious to us that at least to some degree they deserve what they're getting. But I'm talking about those who are ostensibly serving the Lord. They're trying to do what is right. They've given their lives to that. How do you explain that? Well, somebody says, you know, you turn back to Genesis chapter 3, and in the beginning, when sin was introduced to the world, then mortality was one of the consequences of sin. The physical death, the suffering, the pain, the mortality of the body, and all of this relates to the sin back in Genesis 3. Yeah, I know, generally speaking, as we're talking about the sin, the suffering of the world, generally speaking, we know Genesis chapter 3, that's where it all began. But I want to tell you, as I am struggling with my faith, and I suspect, as you struggle at times with your own realities in life, what we want to know is not, well, why is there suffering in the world? That's not really the question that brings us to our knees. It's not just, why do people sometimes have to die? It's not just, why is there sickness and disease in the world? It's not nearly that generic. I'll tell you, the thing that brings us to our knees and gets us honest once and for all before our God is not just the question of why do people have to die? The question is, why did my child have to die? That's the question. It's not just why is there sickness and suffering in the world? The question is, why is my godly mother having to go through this? It's not just a question of why is it that families are having problems and you're seeing so many divorce. No, the question is, here is a woman who is giving her life to the rearing of her children, honoring God, serving Him faithfully. Why did it have to be her marriage that ended that way? And so, Job had some very serious questions to ask. And his friends, one after another, speech after speech, were suggesting to him in one way or another, come on, Job, you've done something. Tell us what it is. Admit your sin. Confess. Get honest about this. And Job was saying, I'm telling you, that's not the answer. That's not the problem. I don't understand this. I wish God would explain it. I wish He would tell me something. I wish the Lord would come and let me know what's going on here. And so, in the midst of all of that that's going on, with Job offering his complaints, with him issuing his rebuttals, with him honestly addressing the questions that he has, not only about the realities of life in general, but the realities of his life, his pain, his suffering, his loss. And as he is asking the question, why, Lord? Why won't you explain it? Why won't you tell me? Why won't you talk to me? The Lord then asked him, Job, who do you think you are? Who is this who darkeneth counsel with words without knowledge? Who gave you the right to stand up and ask the God and the Creator of this universe what He was doing or why? And to question whether or not I am running this world properly. Job, have you forgotten? I am God. You are not. Beginning in Job chapter 38, the Lord begins a series of questions back to Job. After he's listened to all that's gone on up to this point, the Lord interjects and says, just who do you think you are? And have you forgotten who I am? One of the reasons that this principle is so impressive to us is because we're living in a world that has forgotten who God is. And we have forgotten who we are. In Romans chapter 1, the Apostle Paul gives there the most succinct treatise on humanism that you'll find anywhere in the world. particular. The most succinct treatment of humanism you'll find in all the Bible.
In Romans chapter 1, the Apostle Paul describes what happens to a people when they refuse to have God in their knowledge. They were without excuse because both the power and the divinity of God could be clearly perceived through the things that were made, Romans 1 and verse 20. They were without excuse for not knowing God. And yet, in their own sophistication, in their own wisdom, as they fell in love with their own minds, let me warn you, underlying much of what is going on in this country with the moral and spiritual demise of our society is this principle. We have become a people who have fallen in love with our own wisdom, with our own minds, with our own intelligence. Professing themselves to be wise, they became fools. Worship the creature rather than the Creator. There have always been cycles in the history of men when, in their sophistication, men declared God to be dead. And after declaring God to be dead, obsolete, gone, we've outgrown that, too sophisticated for it, then immediately declaring themselves to be in charge and responsible for the ongoing operation of this world. It's to that kind of attitude that God responds. And he asked the question, who do you think you are? Job's line of reasoning was really, in a sense, causing God to be obligated to him. Up to this point, as Job is talking, he's looking at his life. He's trying to understand what's going on. His friends are saying, Job, there's some heinous crime, some sin in your heart. That's the explanation for all of this evil. Job is saying, no, it's not. That's not fair. I haven't done anything like that. That doesn't describe me. I wish the Lord would come. I wish he would just explain this. I wish I could ask him a question. If we could just sit across the table from each other. Lord, you owe me an explanation. I want to know why. And the Lord said, is that right, Job? Who do you think you are that I have to answer to you regarding your life in this world? Do you remember in Romans chapter 9? Isn't that essentially the point that the Apostle Paul makes here when he talks about the relationship of the clay to the potter? Romans chapter 9, we'll begin in verse 19. I will say then unto me, when doth he still find fault? For who withstandeth his will? Nay, but, O man, who art thou that repliest against God? Shall the thing formed say to him that formed it, why did you make me like this? Or does not the potter have a right over the clay from the same lump to make one part a vessel unto honor, and the other a vessel unto dishonor? Here is the principle, here's the premise. God is God. He is the potter. The clay is in his hands. Does he not have a right to take the clay and do with it as he will? Can you imagine the clay as is being formed and fashioned? Can you imagine the clay turning around and saying to the potter, why did you make me like this? It's an absurd thing. Lord has reminded us that we are the clay and he is the potter. And whether we understand or not, whether we like it or not, he will do as he wills. I am God. You are not. You don't tell me. I tell you. Let me tell you. Well, our society has just lost touch with this. Can you imagine in our age of moral relativism? Can you imagine someone saying definitively with some voice of authority, you must, whatever is follows that. I would say to people, you must not, whatever you're going to say. We're living in a society that absolutely rebels immediately at the idea that there are any musts and must nots, concerning which we must submit ourselves. Who is this? Who do you think you are? Acting as if I owe you something. Let me say something about this point and then we'll move on. I want you to appreciate the principle here. The Lord is not saying to us, don't cry, it doesn't hurt that bad. He never said don't cry. The Lord never said, you know, it's not really that sad, just straighten up. There are some things that are really sad. What he said was, I am God. And I am going to do what is right. You are the creature. I am the creator. Don't lose sight of that. God does not answer to me. I answer to Him. That's the relationship. And then there was the next question. Job, have you lost your integrity? Job chapter 2, verse 9. His wife asked him sarcastically, Job, do you still maintain your integrity after all this happened? You've lost all of your financial net worth. You've lost all your animals, all your cattle, all your sheep, all your camels, all your oxen. You've lost all your family. You've lost your sons. You've lost your daughters. You've lost their houses. You've lost your farmland. You've lost it all. Job, now look at you. You're pitiful, covered in boils from head to toe, sitting around scratching your scabs off. A pitiful, pitiful person. Do you still maintain your integrity? Curse God and die. You know what Job needed from his wife, if he had ever needed it, was a little bit of encouragement. I think sometimes in the family of God, when we are going through what may well prove to be the worst adversity of our lifetime, I think sometimes we need to remember, as we're seeing a brother who's passing through the fire, what he may need more than anything else at the moment is a helping hand and a word of encouragement. Job, do you still maintain your integrity? Interesting word back in verse 3. The Lord said unto Satan, Job 2 and verse 3, after all had been taken away, Job was still faithful. Have you considered my servant Job? There is none like him in all the earth, a perfect and an upright man, one that fears God and turns away from evil, and he still holds fast his integrity. The word integrity, sometimes translated perfect. Turn back to Job chapter 1 and verse 1. There was a man in the land of Uz, whose name was Job, and that man was perfect. That word perfect is the same word. It's translated there, integrity. Integrity, integrated, having all of its parts. A machine that has all of its integral parts is complete. It means there's nothing missing. A person with integrity is whole, is sound, is complete. Job started out, Job chapter 1 and verse 1, the Holy Spirit tells us about Job, he was a man of integrity, perfect and upright. He was a man that had everything, the animals, the land, the houses, the family. He had it all. He lost his animals, he lost his land, he lost his houses. But do you see in Job chapter 2 and verse 3, do you see after he lost everything he had physically that the Lord said of him, Job 2 and verse 3, he still maintains his integrity. Have you looked at Job? The Lord said to Satan. He's still got it. He's still got everything. He's whole. He's complete. And his wife, recognizing that, said, I'm not believing this. Job, do you still maintain your integrity? Curse God and die. Amazing. How can you still have it together like that? You ever see someone who was in the final stages of a disease which was just sapping away the physical strength of the body? Very often accompanied by the atrophy of muscle tissue, the paleness of the skin, weakness and feebleness. And sometimes as we see a person in that situation, still trying as much as they can to come to worship God, to be with God's people. Someone will nudge the person next to him and point. Look. He's just half the man he was this 6 months ago. Really? Is that true, that he's just half the man? See, here's the challenge. These days under the sun, I may lose my health. I may lose it tomorrow. I may lose my wealth. Both dollars that I have with me. I may lose my spouse. I may lose my children. Something may happen to some of my friends. I don't know. It may be that in the coming days I am going to suffer every conceivable calamity and disaster known to man. And when all of that has happened to me, when all of that has afflicted me, when all of that has been stripped away and taken away from me, I can still be a whole and complete man as long as I am standing beside my Lord. And so Job, as one thing after another was snatched away from him, and then if his plight was not bad enough, his friends were there insulting him and challenging his intelligence and his integrity, and his wife was saying, curse God and die. In the midst of all of that, as Job was suffering and scratching the scabs and crying out in pain to his God, Job's attitude was still the same in Job chapter 13 and in verse 15. He said, I want to tell you something, though he slay me, yet will I trust him. I'm telling you, he was a whole man. And I'll tell you, the question that we have to answer in life is not the question of, is suffering finally going to come to an end in our lifetime? I can tell you the answer to that tonight. It's not. The question that we're grappling with really is not, are we going to finally arrive at a time when in our technology, in our progress, in our wisdom and intelligence, are we going to finally be able to remove all illness and disease and tragedy and do away with war and have peace? And will all the unhappiness in life, is it finally going to be removed from the experience of human beings in this world? And the answer is no, that's not going to happen. The question is not, Are we finally going to reform and reshape and remake this world so that finally, once and for all, we can get it the way it's supposed to be? No, we're not going to do that. The question is simply this. Are we going to rise to the challenge of the day, whatever comes our way? The challenges presented to us by a sinful and a tragedy-struck world, and are we in the midst of that, as we address the challenge, are we going to remain faithful to our Lord? Are we going to retain our integrity? That's the question. And if we're willing to do that, whatever comes our way in the few days that we're making our journey through this world. I tell you, folks, we sing that song, "This world is not our home, we're just passing through." We need to come to believe that. If we retain our faith to meet the challenges that come to us day by day in this life, then we can say with Job, "I don't know. I don't understand. I cannot explain this, but I know one thing. Though he slay me, I'll still trust in him." See, whatever's happening to us on the outside, if we have all the parts on the inside put together properly in Jesus Christ, then he'll see us through. And we're going to be all right. Now, as we approach the third, the final question, and we'll be done, I'm going to ask you something. Why was the book of Job written? Why was the book written? Somebody said, well, the book of Job was written to explain the problem of human suffering. I don't think so. Somebody says, why don't you think so? Because it does not explain the problem of suffering. It reveals the reality of suffering. But it doesn't answer the questions that we grapple with in our individual lives on this earth. Job lived and died without knowing even as much as we know about his suffering. Why was the book of Job written? It was written to address this question that Satan posed to the Lord. You see, when all of this started, Satan said, "You know, Job's serving you, but look at his life, okay? It doesn't count, really. Here's the question," Satan said. "Here's what I want to know. Will a man serve God for naught? Will he serve God for nothing?" Satan's argument was, "Job serves you, okay, but look, man, he's on the payroll, and look at his check. Sure, he's serving you. Everybody would serve you if you paid him like that. No problem here. But you take that away from him, he'll curse you to your face." Satan's argument was, "Job will not serve you just to serve you." Is that right? As a matter of fact, why would anybody serve? Well, we could start making a long list of reasons why people would serve God, but fundamentally, there are probably about three reasons why anyone would serve the Lord. First one is fear. The Bible doesn't disguise this as a motivation. Fear. It's a fearful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. I do not want to spend eternity in the torment that's been prepared for the devil and his angels. I do not want to die and go to hell. I'm afraid of that.
Somebody says, well, I don't think you ought to try to scare people, you know, with hell just to and trying to get them to serve God. I don't think that's a good motivation.
The Lord used it. From Genesis to Revelation, He used it. Why would anybody serve God? Fear.
But there's another reason. Reward.
It's not just that I don't want to go to hell, but the fact of the matter is, Jesus told me about heaven. Jesus told me about a place that was being prepared for the faithful. I want to go to be with my Lord. I want to be in the prepared place. I want to be in the place where the elders, the heavenly host, are gathered around the throne of the Lamb and singing His praises throughout all eternity. I want to go to heaven. Peter said in 1 Peter 1 and verse 3, that we have been begotten again unto a living hope, to an inheritance incorruptible, undefiled, that fades not away. Isn't that a powerful motivation for you?
That when all is said and done, when our few days on this earth are over, however good or however difficult they may be, there is something far better that will never end. It's a wonderful motivation. Why would anyone serve the Lord? Fear. Reward. Nothing. Here's the question. If there were not any heaven toward which I aspire, and if there were not any hell of which I am fearful, would I still serve God just because He is God? We're talking about relationship here. The relationship of the creature to the Creator. Would I serve Him just because He is my God and He created me? That's essentially what Job finally comes to. I don't understand. I can't explain this. I wish the Lord would say something about this. But the one thing I know, I'm going to be faithful to Him no matter what.